Amen. All right, we're in Malachi chapter 3. We left off in verses 8, 9, and 10 of Malachi chapter 3. A section that's probably familiar to many. Going through Malachi is one of those things that it's like, okay, we're going through here, but we've plowed through some topics in the last couple of weeks that preachers often would rather, hop over, or sometimes can be disproportional. But nonetheless, that's where we are. Malachi 3 verses 8, 9, and 10. Will a man rob God? Yet you've robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed thee? This has been the pattern in the book of Malachi, right? The statement, and then the prophet speaks in anticipating the answer of the people. God says this, but you're going to say this. Well, here's the answer to this rhetorical question. Wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. You're cursed with a curse, for you've robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, saith the Lord of hosts, and all nations shall call you blessed, for ye shall be a delightsome land, saith the Lord of hosts. So here you see in verse number 8, the tithes and offerings. The tithe is a word that means the tenth. But, as we mentioned this in the conclusion last week, trying to tie it all together, but both are part of God's expectation for his children. It is a step of growth for any believer, whether young in the faith or whether many years in the Lord. It is a step of growth to learn to say, all right, I am going to designate a tenth of what God gives me, and I'm going to give it back to him as an offering. But when we get to that point where, and it ought to be habitual, it ought to be understood, okay, this is what I got, this much is the tithe, this much is what the tax man took, so this is what I have left to work with. That ought to be understood, that ought to be expected as we get to a certain point in our life that this is God's portion. And, quite honestly, I would be afraid if I took that money and went out to eat that I'd choke on it. Or if I spent it to buy something, it would blow up. I thank the Lord that I was taught that by my parents from a young age, and throughout church. That's the expectation, that tenth, that 10% off the top, that belongs to the Lord. But if you're to that point, if I'm to that point where we say, all right, this is God's portion, we need to say with Paul in the New Testament, not as though I'd already attained, either were already perfect, but I follow after. Not as though, all right, that's the height of spirituality, if I could say it that way, because God says they've robbed him in tithes and offerings. So the tenth would be a minimum, and offerings would be, on top of that. In the Jewish economy, there were required offerings, the burnt offering, the meat offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering. Some were required, some were voluntary. And so there were offerings beyond the tithe of their increase. And God says that when they had withheld the tithe, they had robbed God. Verse 9, you're cursed with a curse, for you've robbed me. The reason you're suffering judgment is because you've robbed me. And so based on verse number 10, what can we surmise was the justification for withholding the tithe? Prove me now herewith, saith the Lord, bring you all the tithes into the storehouse that there may be meat, and prove me now herewith if I will not open the windows of heaven. We can almost surmise that their justification was, well, if I give this portion to God, I won't have enough to live on. Okay? That seems to be the underlying reason. I can't afford to do this. Now, financially, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I have applied to the bank for a loan to buy a house before, and they have come back with an approval for more. They want to know your income and how long you've been working there and all that kind of stuff. But they will come back with an approval that they would approve me for more house than I ought to buy. But I look at that and go, okay, well, looking at percentages of income. I'm looking at it going, nope, this part goes here. This is the Lord's part, and this goes to missions, and so this is the part that I'm operating on, okay? But it doesn't make sense to the bank that why would you just take 10% or 10% plus a gift and, give that to a church. That doesn't make sense to the accountant necessarily. But that if we simply operate in that realm, and I speak that way because, you know, pastor mentions that from time to time, but I do operate in the realm of numbers. And, you know, does it make sense? Does it add up? Does it compute? And in one sense, it doesn't compute. But, you know, from a human standpoint, it doesn't always make sense. But God says, prove me. Okay? That idea of prove me is try me. Of course, you know, as parents, there's two ways we use that. One would be, okay, well, just try me. You try it and see if I don't reward you. The other way has a little more edge to it, right? All right, you go ahead and do that. You just try me. Okay? This is not a try me in the sense of you're going to be chasing for crossing a line. This is try me. The God says, just try it. You don't think you can trust me? Just try it. But it says, prove me now herewith, saith the Lord, if I will not open the windows of heaven. Now, where are the tithes and offerings to be brought? Into the storehouse. That word, storehouse, is also used in other places in the Old Testament, and it's translated the treasury, okay? Or the treasury, the chambers, the storehouse. You know, it's translated different ways, but the idea is it was at the house of God. So, yes, what does that mean? That means the tithes go to the house of God, not to the TV preacher, okay? The tithes go to the house of God, not to, you know, your favorite ministry. You know, maybe it's Ambassador Baptist College, I don't know. You know, maybe it's Crown College, maybe it's, you know, some other ministry like that. The tithes go to the house of God, which is the storehouse, which is the church, all right? And then if you want to give offerings or gifts to those others on top of that, that's certainly appropriate. But he says, prove me now herewith, and see if I will not open the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. The windows of heaven. The first time we read that phrase, I apologize in advance, but I'm going to struggle more if I don't pop a cough drop in here. The weather change and the drainage is getting to me a little bit. The windows of heaven. The first time we see that term is in Genesis chapter 7. What happened in Genesis chapter 7? Yep, the rain. God sent Noah into the ark, and then he opened the windows of heaven, and here came the rain. It was an overwhelming supply. In 2 Kings chapter 7, one of the king's aides scoffed. They were in the midst of a famine, and the city was surrounded. And the prophet said, tomorrow this time, food's going to be so cheap you can't imagine it. And he said, if God would open the windows of heaven, could that thing even happen? So the idea of open the windows of heaven is the idea of an overwhelming abundance, an overwhelming supply, more than you can comprehend. And God says here, if we will prove him and prioritize him in our offerings, that he will open the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing that there not be room enough to receive it. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say, sow your seed gift of $100 on your credit card and God will pay $1,000 on that. That's what charlatans and crooks do. Okay, they're false teachers, they're deceivers and manipulators. But so it doesn't always look like that. How does it look? Sometimes it looks like the cars most of us have in the parking lot. They're not brand new, but they're still running. You know, sometimes it looks like, you know, you have maybe fewer medical bills, or the medical bills get taken care of from different avenues that the world and the accountant don't always understand. You know, sometimes it looks like a lack of problems. You know, you have things that don't tear up, you know, break down, whatever. God takes care of our needs sometimes by preventing the need, if I could say it that way, and other times by providing for the need in different means. But how God takes care of us may look different, but God has promised if we will put him to the test and prioritize him in our tithes and offerings, that he will bless us more than we can hold, more than we have capacity for. That's really the idea there. Not room enough to receive it is beyond capacity. But look at verse 11. He says, I'm going to rebuke the devourer for your sake. Okay? So, that's the contrast. Verse 9 says, they're cursed with a curse. Verse 11, rebuke the devourer. And so basically the contrast is, if you put God first, you'll be blessed. If you refuse to trust God in that way, there's a famine, there's a devourer. It says the fruits of your vine will cast her fruit before time. In other words, God says, I'm going to get it one way or the other. Or if I could say it another way, God says, if you decide you're going to keep it from me, I'll make sure that you don't get to use it. Okay, that might be a better way to explain it. God knows how, if I decide I'm going to keep this and spend it on this, God knows how to make sure I get two or three extra bills that's way more than the portion that I kept, right? How well did it work out for Achan to try to keep things back? Anyway, that was a voluntary offering, different scenario, but I'm just making an application. But here, verse 11, God says, I will rebuke the devourer. You know what that reminds me of? The book of Job. You know, when God, Satan went to Job, went to God and said, look, you've put a hedge around Job. I'd love to touch him, but I can't. Okay? God is able to do the same for you and me, right? He says, I'll rebuke the devourer. In other words, I'll not allow him to touch your things. Verse 12, all nations shall call you blessed. In other words, the other peoples of the earth will recognize God's blessing. All right, and that brings us then to the next section, the last section of chapter 3. Excuse me. There is profit in serving God. Now notice in verse number 13, your words have been stout against me, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, when have we spoken so much against thee? Here is the same pattern that Malachi has used throughout the book. He speaks for God and then anticipates how the people are going to respond. Now, when you hear the term stout, some of you think of it in reference to size. You know, sometimes you look at a football player and go, boy, that boy looks stout. Okay? We might look at ourselves after Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, feasting season and say, wow, I'm more stout than I used to be. Okay? But here, the term stout, it means strong or firm, okay? But the idea is, we sometimes use that term a little differently. We say, boy, look at that branch. That branch on that tree is stout, okay? If you're looking to hang a swing for your kids, or maybe, you know, hang a tire swing or a traditional swing or whatever, you're looking for a branch that's stout, not one that's flimsy, right? And the basic idea of the term stout means strong or firm. Well, if you're firm in resisting God, what would we call that? Rebellious, stubborn. If you go further down into the thesaurus, you might come up with the word impudent, okay? But that's what the term means here. The idea your words have been stout, it's that there's been a determined, strong, firm resistance to God. That's the idea here. Your words have been stout against me, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, when did we do this? Verse 14, ye have said, it is vain to serve God. And what profit is it that we've kept his ordinance, that we walk mournfully before the Lord of hosts? And now we call the proud happy. Yea, they that work wickedness are set up. They that tempt God are delivered. Don't raise a hand, please. But have you ever been tempted to think, I'm trying to live for God and do what's right, and it seems like those people over there don't have any problems and they have all the money? I mean, it's easy to be tempted to think that way. We have to choose to think differently in that situation. But in essence, what were they doing? They were speaking against God. So their accusation here, I took this main point here from verse number 14, where they said, it is vain to serve God. Vain means empty or worthless. Okay? It's the idea of the people that there's no point, there's no benefit, there's no profit in serving God. Was that true? No, that was not true. In fact, God said in verse number 10, prove me and see if I'll bless you more than you can even comprehend. So this was not true, but have you ever come up with a scenario in your mind and made it as a justification for this or that? And, you know, boy, that was your reason and that, you know, this is my ground, and it wasn't true? Well, it doesn't have to be true for you to make up a scenario in your mind. It doesn't have to be factual for you to believe it. I mean, some people think Florida's a good football team. Anyway, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. But it was fun. It doesn't have to be factual for a person to believe it. And in the same way, it's not factual to say there's no benefit in serving God, but some had convinced themselves that wasn't true. Maybe they had just gotten discouraged in difficult times. Maybe that was a justification for going the way they'd already decided they wanted to go anyway. Okay? And that, well, there's no benefit in serving God anyway, so it doesn't matter if I go do this. I mean, there's a lot of what ifs, but their accusation was there's no profit. The proud or happy, and the wicked are blessed, and you know, there's nothing left for us. So they were speaking against God and against His goodness. Now, what's the context of this in history? Okay, remember, Nehemiah and Ezra have come back. Jerusalem's been rebuilt. Ezra came back and really helped to try to reestablish the priesthood, reestablish the preaching of the law and all that. Malachi is maybe 25 years after that. Is there any profit in serving God? I mean, didn't God bring them back from Babylon? Didn't God allow Jerusalem to be rebuilt? Hasn't God, you know, allowed His word to be preserved and all of that? I mean, they're back in the land. They had, for 70 years, they've been captive in Babylon. What's the likelihood at that point, humanly speaking, they're ever going to be released to go back? Not likely. I mean, just from that little window, we could say, well, this is faulty reasoning, but it doesn't have to be factual for us to talk ourselves into it. But in verses 16 through 18, you see the contrast. They said, well, there's no profit in serving God. Verses 16 through 18, then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before Him for them that feared the Lord and that thought on His name. They shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not. I see a very strong parallel here in verse number 16 to a New Testament passage. They that feared the Lord spake often to one another. I see a lot of a parallel to Hebrews 10:25. Not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together, and so much the more as you see the day approaching, the benefit of that, you know, mutual encouragement that we receive from talking to one another about the Lord, from meeting together to worship the Lord. They that feared the Lord spoke often to one another. Why is that necessary to speak and then in the next phrase to write a book of remembrance? Why is that necessary? Because what works better, your rememberer or your forgetter? It's bad grammar, but you get the point. Our forgetters work far better than our memory, okay? And we tend to be prisoners of the moment. Oh, that was awful. Fire the coach. Hey, we won the game. Give him a raise. Oh, preacher said something I didn't like. You know, he's hateful. You know, preacher showed up and helped us when we had something going on in our family. It was just a blessing and encouragement. He's the best person there. You know, we tend to be prisoners of the moment sometimes. Whether it's in our walk with the Lord or our family circumstances or our job or our politics. Whatever, you know, we could tend to be tunnel vision. And it requires kind of a big picture view for us to zoom out a little bit. Say, no, wait a minute. What has God done for us? What has God done? And as they began to rehearse the blessings of God, this is what God's done. This is how God's kept His promises. These are the promises God's continued to make. As they encouraged one another and wrote down those blessings of God in a book, they drew strength from that. I mean, there's all kinds of principles. We can go all the way back to Joshua chapter 4 where God told Joshua to make a memorial, right? They took the stones out of the river and they built a memorial. And that's been a pattern over and over and over again. Whether it's studying for school or whether it's remembering God's blessings, a short pencil is better than a long memory. In other words, we're more likely to remember it if we write it down somewhere. And here they wrote it down. They began to remind themselves of God's blessings. And God here says, they shall be mine. You notice, they shall be mine when I make up my jewels. Jewels are those things which are precious, valuable. I think there's probably a comparison in the New Testament to another description from Exodus. Exodus chapter 19, God told Israel they were going to be a peculiar treasure unto Him. Well, would that fit when I make up my jewels? Okay, well, is that word peculiar used in the New Testament anywhere that we're familiar with? Maybe 1 Peter chapter 2. You're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. And God says, I'm going to remember you. I'm going to reward those that trust me and follow me. But it says, they shall be mine. Who's they? Back in verse 16, the ones that feared the Lord. That's the ones that'll be His, that will make up His jewels and be spared of the Lord. Okay? Verse 18, then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked. Okay, what will be the end result of God's work? Well, the righteous will be rewarded and the wicked will be exposed and judged. Compare that with verse 15. The proud are happy and the wicked are blessed. Now, what's the real end of the story? The true end of the story is that God will vindicate who's righteous and who's wicked, those that are serving God and those that aren't. But to get to that point requires the long view. It requires patience. It requires faithfulness. It requires trust and waiting on God to vindicate those. But so you have in chapters 2 and 3, you have the sins of the priest and then the sins of the people. And then in chapter 4, we wrap up the book of Malachi with a discussion of the day of the Lord. Verse number 1, for behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, and it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And you shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And you shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet. In the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember you the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. You see three things here in this chapter. Number one, we see that a future day of judgment is a theme throughout the prophets. Chapter 4, verse 1, behold, the day cometh. We see this same thing. I gave you a bunch of references. I'm not going to look at all of them, but I just wanted to document. Every once in a while, I like to make an assertion and document it. And you know, Zephaniah chapter 1, the great verse number 14 and 15, the great day of the Lord is near. It is near and hasteth greatly, even the voice of the day of the Lord. The mighty man shall cry there bitterly. It's a day of wrath, a day of trouble, a day of distress, a day of waste and desolation, darkness and gloominess. Joel 1 and verse 15, alas for the day of the Lord is at hand. Joel chapter 2, verse 31, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. Oh, the day of the Lord is a consistent theme throughout the prophets, speaking of God's judgment, a day of final judgment. Okay, that future day of judgment is a theme throughout the prophets. And what I think what we see here is the ultimate fulfillment is yet future in what we would call, you know, the tribulation and Armageddon and Gog and Magog and all of those events. It would include both God's judgment on Jerusalem and God's judgment on the nations. Okay, all of that would be kind of the ultimate fulfillment. But I think there was fulfillment along the way of these things as well, right? Was Jerusalem destroyed multiple times? I mean, even after the time of Malachi, you have the so-called silent years where there were no writing prophets from the time of Malachi till the birth of Christ. And then about 30-ish years after the time of Christ, then Jerusalem was destroyed and remained desolate as far as Israel's possession of it and so forth for 1900 years. So, yes, that those things have been fulfilled along and along, but the ultimate fulfillment of the day of the Lord is primarily future. So that theme, but here then we're going to see two basic themes here in chapter 4. Number one, you have the day of the Lord for the wicked. And then we see the day of the Lord from the perspective of the righteous or from the perspective of God's children. In verses 1 and 3, we see what the day of the Lord means from the perspective of the wicked. That day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud and all that do wickedly shall be as stubble. Well, that's not the stubble that the men have on their face because they didn't shave in a couple of days. Of course, that's the cuttings that are left over from harvesting the field. Farmers near us have been harvesting soybeans the last couple of weeks. And they got the cutting head on the combine, and it cuts off the top part of the stalks, and sometimes more than that. But the internal, those combines are amazing things. That cutting head harvests it. It goes internally and it separates the stalk. There are other mechanisms in there that separate the beans from the hull. And then out the back, there's like a spreader wheel, and it chops it up and it's spraying stubble out the back. It's the hay, the rest of the stalks of that plant and the leaves and whatever. It's chopped up and sprayed on the ground. They do the same thing with wheat if they're not going to. Sometimes they'll cut just the heads off of that and then come back and cut it for straw or for, you know, wheat straw. But the stubble is what's left over. This imagery, if you think about that, the dried stalks of the plant that's left, is there strength in that? Will a fire kindle in that easily? Sure. I mean, that's what that dry grass, dry leaves, that's what you'd use to help get a fire started if you're trying to start a little campfire or cooking fire or whatever. But this idea of God consuming with fire and consuming the stubble is here in Malachi. We see it in Obadiah, verse number 18. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble, and they shall kindle in them. In Zechariah, we see that continued theme of fire representing God's judgment. In that day, will I make the governors of Judah like a hearth of fire among the wood, and like a torch of fire in a sheath, you know, a bundle of straw, wheat. So, from the perspective of the wicked, you have this judgment and being consumed and fire and all of that kind of thing. It's very interesting. This exact imagery is used in Matthew chapter 3 when John the Baptist introduces Jesus. This isn't that far. We'll turn over to Matthew chapter 3, maybe a couple of pages to your right. Or if you have a study Bible, there might be a few extra pages of notes between the Old and New Testament. But Matthew chapter 3, verse number 10. Now also the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Therefore every tree which bringeth not forth fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. I indeed baptize you with water, but he that cometh after me is mightier than I, whose shoes I'm not worthy to bear. He shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost and with fire. Whose fan is in his hand, he will thoroughly purge his floor, gather the wheat into the garner, but will burn up the chaff with fire, unquenchable fire. Okay, this same idea here, and then again, in verse number 3, you shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet. Verses 1 and 3 give the idea of judgment and the wicked being consumed and God giving judgment by fire. But this exact imagery was used by John the Baptist when he was introducing Jesus as the Messiah, as, you know, the one who would bring God's judgment. That's interesting because in verse number 5 here of chapter 4, he says, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord." Was John the Baptist, in fact, Elijah the prophet? Yeah, I think he was. Talk about that under the next heading. But you have the day of the Lord from the perspective of the wicked. It's fire and it's judgment. But the part that we may not always think about, what is the day of the Lord from the perspective of the righteous? Look at verse number 2. Verse 1, there's fire and they're going to be consumed as stubble. Verse 2, but unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And you shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. Healing in his wings. What is the imagery in the scripture often of wings? Whether it's the wings of a bird, you know, comfort, protection. Yes, exactly. And so the idea, the Son shall arise with healing in his wings. The idea there is comfort, protection, and healing. You know, to be able to soothe that which has been made raw or injured or whatever that. I mean, but does the Son have wings? I mean, notice that's the Son of Righteousness, like S-U-N, like the ball of fire in the sky. The Son doesn't have wings, but are there times when the Son can bring comfort? Sure. You know, maybe, you know, darkness and now, hey, we're getting some daylight. That can bring comfort. But we're going into the colder months. When we get into springtime and you walk outside and boy, there's just a warm day and things are starting to get a little bit green, doesn't that just bring encouragement and comfort? Sure it does. And that's the analogy here, though, that the Messiah would be like the Son of Righteousness. That phrase there in the end of verse 2, grow up as calves of the stall. What is that idea there, the calves of the stall? Okay, it's not one that's out in the field that's got to fend for themselves. The ones that are in the stall have shelter, they have protection, they're usually well fed, right? I mean, in fact, if you're going to butcher beef, often you pin the cows up for usually at least 21 days and feed them sweet corn and stuff to sweeten up the meat before you butcher it and process the meat. But the idea of the calf of the stall, again, it's picturing God's protection, God's provision for them. In Isaiah, this idea of the sun being a comparison for the Christ the Messiah, in Isaiah 9, chapter 2, this phrase may be familiar even if you couldn't give the reference. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. Again, that would be a good, I think, analogy for the Son of Righteousness being the Messiah. And then, of course, in verse 3, we've already talked about that. Verse 4, I think this is kind of the crux of this final message right here. Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb. Okay? God, it's interesting that this is the final instruction of God to the children of Israel. Now, they have disobeyed. God sent them prophets. Sometimes they listened, sometimes they didn't. But they had this cycle of obey and then disobey, and obey and disobey throughout the times of the judges and really throughout the times of the kings to a certain extent. But when you have this final message, remember ye the law of Moses, my servant. Could we not summarize the message of the prophets as obey God, do what you're supposed to do? Right? In many cases, the prophet was just saying, you know what you've been told to do. Just do what you're supposed to do. Just obey God. Right? It's very interesting to me that this is basically the last word that they were going to have from the writing prophets. God says, all right, from the start of the prophets in Obadiah and Jonah and some of the earliest ones to Malachi, the very last of them, we're talking about a period of 400 years. For 400 years, God has sent the messengers over and over and over again. So finally, God says, look, I've said everything I'm going to say. Here's the bottom line. You remember the law of Moses, or I could reword it for you and me. Here's the bottom line. Obey God's word. You have it. You should know what to do, and I'm not going to say it again for a while. You ever get to that point with your children or your students or whatever the case? Look, I've said this 100 different ways. I don't know how to say it any other way. This is the bottom line. Do this. I'm not going to say it again. I almost get a little bit of that sense here in Malachi chapter 4. He says, remember the law of Moses. Then in verses 5 and 6, it says, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Of course, that Elijah the prophet, if we compare that to Luke chapter 1 and Matthew chapter 11 and Matthew chapter 17, I thought I had put those the text of those verses in my notes, but I hadn't. But you'd see that Elijah is clearly seen to be John the Baptist. In some of those instances in the Gospels, in one case, Jesus said, speaking of John the Baptist, he said, this is Elias, if you will receive it. In Luke chapter 1, speaking to his father, the angel told Zacharias, he will go before the Messiah in the spirit and power of Elias. So, you know, this Elijah was a prophecy of the ministry of John the Baptist. And basically God says, look, obey the law of Moses, and then I'm going to send you Elijah before the Lord, the coming of the Lord. And we know that's the next thing that happens, right? It's just about 400 years in between. So in the end of Malachi here, we have God saying, all right, I've said everything I'm going to say. The bottom line is, remember the law of Moses and oh, keep my statutes and judgments. And then the next thing we're going to see is Elijah the prophet. We'll summarize it and give a few final thoughts next time, but we need to stop there for today.